Welcome to The Rest is Shifty, a podcast highlighting the eclectic legacy of Shifty Records, South Africa's fiercely independent cult record label operating through the dark days of apartheid into the democratic era. I'm Warwick Sony.
And I'm Lloyd Ross. Each episode will feature a classic album from our catalogue. Today,
Sankamota.
So this was our first recording for Shifty, Warwick, but it was also our first mobile recording.
Yeah, we took the studio down to Lesotho, which is the only country in the whole world that is surrounded by another country.
You can almost visualize those mountains around Maseru.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember the pictures that we took, the promo pics. I think maybe when you were recording the album
on the mountains.
Yeah. So it's got the vibe, right?
Yeah, I'm just listening.
So that's you playing tabla.
And I think I played it there, in fact, or was it later?
I think it was in Joburg you played.
In Joburg, yeah. Oh. Okay, so that was Ramasela. What was that about again? I remember you put all the English translations on the cover.
I did. Ramasela, hey, the baby is crying. What bitter? It's the lizard.
The lizard, that's right.
Where did the lizard bite her?
On the bum.
On the bum. Give her tea. There's no sugar. I don't know if you can remember when you had a kid. Once when my daughter was like 1 year old, we were in Germany.
Yeah.
She got bitten by a hornet.
Oh.
And she just cried and cried and cried. And eventually we actually went into a doctor's office because we didn't know what to do with her.
Yeah.
He pulled out a sweet and gave it to her and she stopped crying. So I think that's maybe where the is no sugar comes in here.
Yeah, and they used to often dip the dummy into a whole sugar and just plug it into the baby's mouth.
So then the lyric continues, where is his mother? Gone to the field. And where is her father? Gone to the boers. So obviously the father was on the mines.
Yeah.
Which is actually something that Frank Liepa, the Supremo in Sankamota, went to go and do at a certain time of his life. But we can come to that story later. There is no sugar. Did you know, the 18th of October is Frank Liepa's birthday. He was born in 1953 in Maseru, and his dad was in the police force. In fact, he was the second most senior policeman in Lesotho. He was the deputy commissioner of police, and that's a whole story in itself. When the major shit happened with his dad, he was probably like 17. Do you remember that story?
His father was quite a high-ranking police guy in Mashweshwe's government. He was a royalist, wasn't he? And then Laboa Jonathan took over, and he was the bad guy.
There was a time when the British were handing over. I think the election was 1965, yeah. And the British handed over independence in 1966.
To Mashweshwe?
No, he was the king. So it's like the British system. So you have a monarch.
Oh, and a prime minister.
Then you have a prime minister and a parliament as well.
So Laboa was the prime minister.
His father was incredibly well-trained policeman. He'd been to Scotland Yard a couple of times. He'd been training in Australia as well. You know, he was obviously an achiever. There is no sugar. The next elections, that's where the real problem started, because the BNP, the Basotho National Party, they could see they were going to lose the election.
And to who? Who was the...
The BNC, the Basotho National Congress, who were like a little bit socialist.
Well, you have the ANC and then the BNC.
Exactly. They were a bit socialist. So obviously the South African government did not want these guys in.
Yeah, he had this ambiguous relationship with the South African apartheid government, didn't he?
He did. But only later would South Africa regret that, I think.
Yeah.
So I think they supported Laboa Jonathan to actually overturn the election. So he called a state of emergency immediately before the end of the vote count. And by this stage, Clement Liepa, Frank's father, had been forced to retire. And there was this Brit by the name of Roach.
Yeah, this is from the book.
That was actually, he got booted into the commissioner of police there. And Leobora Jonathan actually relied on him to make sure that everything was suppressed that wasn't in favor of him being prime minister. What happened was basically they wanted off Frank's father, Frank Leobora's father.
And he was Morky. His name is Morky as well as
Frank. His name was Morky,
Frank's middle name was Morky.
No, he only adopted that name after his dad died. So Frank's name was Mashlamola, which means sadness, because his grandmother died when he was born. His grandma was in the next room. The child was about to be born in the next room, and she said, "I cannot wait for this boy anymore. I'm going." Then she basically expired, and then Frank was born literally the next minute. That's why his name was Mashlamona, because it's a Basutu tendency to name child after an event, whether it's a happy event or a sad event or whatever.
That's interesting, because what we brought in here immediately, and which was a big part of, and for me also an attractive thing about his songwriting, his lyrics, and the whole thing of Sankamota really was, I wrote an essay called The Hauntologies of Sankamota, which is this haunting quality, which was always got the ghosts, you've got the key in the devil's ribs, you've got this metaphysical world that comes in, and then it actually happens, you know, the band itself, and we probably move into that later with the bad luck they had. You know, I remember someone wrote it somewhere. I think you said it in an interview that they were the unluckiest band.
Just to interrupt you, in fact, the Liepa line, basically nobody had made it to 50 for a long time in their line. Wow. His dad died when he was, his dad was 45.
Yeah.
Frank's brother died when he was 33, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The uncles, everything.
Wow.
And Frank was, he wanted to make it to 50.
Did he?
No, I'm not going to say that. Frank has an interesting career with music. Right from an early age, he was into music. Right from when he was a toddler, basically, totally into music. And later started really interfering with his schooling. And he went to apparently a good Catholic school where they had a great music department. He used to spend all his time in there. And he used to get shut out by the principal or the monks or whatever it is that ran it.
So he went to a Catholic school. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Thank God for the Catholics.
Well, just thank God for the missionaries, really, you know?
Yeah. The same with Lesecca also went to
Christ the King High School.
Yeah, that's a good name.
Eh?
Yeah.
It's a well-endowed music room.
Wow.
And the teachers complained to Clement, his father, about him just skiving off the whole time and just playing music. And I don't know if you remember Frank. He was very quiet.
Yeah, I do remember him very well.
I never heard him raise his voice, and his sister says in her book about
soft-spoken. It even comes out in his. That's what I liked, and I'm sure you liked too when you first saw them playing in the hotel. Is his voice wasn't boisterous and loud. He wasn't like Tsepo.
Mm.
And he was the opposite.
Tsepo Chola. Yeah,
he was very quiet. He had a quiet voice, which was amazing. Like Bob Marley. Bob Marley actually had a quiet voice.
That's right.
You know, when I listened to, I found some separates of Exodus, that album. Someone gave them to Murray, and I was amazed at how quiet Bob Marley's voice was. And it reminded me, I thought Frank had a similar quality. But that was the thing about Frank, is that I think when you saw him, by then he was like a new guy on the block. He'd been playing for years. He was a seasoned musician.
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had that band going for ages. And then before that, they had a band called...
Oh, yeah, the Anti-Antiques.
Anti-Antiques,
yeah.
Quite a hilarious name and quite interesting name.
So his dad didn't spare the whip. You know, he often would let things pass But then once there was a critical mass reached, he would go fucking crazy. And this is what he did with Frank. He was expelled, basically, for non-appearancing class. His dad just thrashed him to within an inch of his life, literally. In the book, Mpoi's sister says, "I thought that he killed him." Apparently he moved him in the house, then he dragged him out by his heels outside, with his head going donk, donk, donk down the stairs, and continued to kick and hit him outside. He gets this terrible beating, but it just doesn't, you know, the passion was there, and he was going to follow it no matter what. He had a school band called the Falcons that played like Wilson Pickett and Percy Sledge and that kind of thing. Remember, they were big in the late 60s.
Yeah, they both came to South Africa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He went to a new high school after he was expelled, and he met Moss Nkorf, who later was a drummer for Sankamorta. So he obviously, school friends from back then, also Pizza Sarah, another school friend that ended up playing in the Sankamorta after we'd recorded them, you know, the bigger band. Anyway, so the father fought for the British in the Second World War, a highly decorated policeman, a very consequent human being, apparently honest and just doing things by the rules. That's what he was into. And when the shit started going down with Leobert Jonathan, when the second election happened, and basically started imprisoning all the
opposition,
leaders.
Yeah.
And he knew the shit was going to come down for him, the father. And he essentially went off into the mountains.
Didn't they have a traditional home there?
They had to stay there because he was moved out of.
He was kicked out of the.
He was kicked out of the nice accommodations in Maseru.
Yeah, right.
And he was basically farming, you know. And there was no other way to support himself because his police salary got his pension, everything went.
Yeah,
they just like completely fucked him.
Yeah,
and when this putsch happened, he knew that the shit was going to come down for him, and he disappeared into the mountains with a whole bunch of followers. So he went off to this cave called La Haheng La Likomo. And apparently the entrance was very difficult to see. It was not such a deep cave, maybe about 20 meters by 15 meters kind of thing.
This is now up in the Maluti Mountains.
Yeah. And this is where in 1970 the Battle of Tabotela happens.
Oh.
This is 22 days after Leobert Jonathan had declared a komatsi state of emergency.
Oh, okay.
Which is in the constitution can only happen for 14 days, but it continued basically for another 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. State of emergency. I remember Frank talked
the
about
whole
that.
Of the 70s, basically.
So that's okay. So we up in the mountains.
We're up in the mountains.
We've got the cave,
and then there's a Judas.
Frank's dad in the cave.
Then there's a Judas.
But there's also the house they were living at. It was up in the mountains.
Yeah, but
the family.
It wasn't up in the. Well, it was in a village.
Yeah.
Not up in the mountains. It was in a valley.
Yeah.
Yeah, before this all happened, Frank was posted on a rock to look out for armored cars coming.
Yes.
This is after the putsch happened. So in that sort of 14-day period, they were very nervous. And then eventually somebody else got killed and Frank's dad, Clement, decided this is the time to head for this cave.
That's right. And one of the things that the police did then against those people who were against it was they burned their houses.
Yeah.
That was actually a notable kind of thing that stayed with Frank.
So there we have a song.
I don't think their house got burned, but it was. I remember reading that other neighbors had their houses burned.
And I think that song is actually House on Fire as more of a metaphor, actually.
Yes. And Palela Mofokeng actually writes quite nicely on that, the metaphorical, the meanings.
He
was very big on the language, Palela.
Anyway, so he gets ratted out, and they went up to go and get him with a helicopter gunship.
The helicopter, SADF helicopter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But Frank's dad, he had this whole thing about the afterlife. He wasn't going to go into the afterlife without taking people with him to the afterlife that were going to make his bed and cook for him and all the rest of it. So he was determined to actually kill as many people as possible before he was killed.
Really?
Anyway, so he killed two Brits. Do you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, two of Roach's friends. This
the British mercenary guy.
Guy.
They must have been mercenaries. Actually,
pretty much,
I suppose. Yeah.
I guess you could term roaches that as well.
Yeah, I think they probably were. And South Africa was awash in mercenaries then because we had the Congo.
You know, the whole arm, they had a whole ground force happening and everything, and then the helicopter. Basically, the helicopter is the thing that killed him with the machine gun from the helicopter because they could actually see into the cave. And I think only two of his party survived.
Like a James Bond movie with a helicopter hovering in front of the cave, just pumping bullets in.
Yeah. You can imagine that.
Yeah.
Essentially, his body was defiled. They dragged him down the mountain.
Yeah.
His guts spilling out. And there was one surviving guy from his crew that said, look, let me take my shirt off and wrap his body in it so he's, like, we can keep him a little bit whole. But when Frank's mother went to go and reclaim the body, apparently all the internal organs were missing. Heart, liver, kidneys.
You mean by design or just by accident? Like a Muti thing?
The retlo, they call it, which is basically you eat the organ of a powerful man. And you gain his power.
So there's a word there for it?
Yeah.
Derretlo.
Derretlo.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Excuse my pronunciation, any Sotho speakers out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was quite a hectic thing. I mean, it's something that stuck with the mother. She was really ruined after this. So, I mean, she's just kept on going for the kids, but she was a defeated woman.
Yeah. So I wonder how old Frank was then. If he was sitting on a stone keeping watch, he would have been at least 14 or 15.
Eh? He would have been 17.
Teenager.
Born in 1950, 1970.
Yeah.
And then the family were outcasts because apparently the news was all like these guys were trying to overthrow the governments and all that kind of thing. Meanwhile, they were loyalists. Moshoeshoe at this time, King Moshoeshoe II, had gone into exile.
That's right. That's why I thought that there was beef between Laboa and the royal.
Well, there definitely was.
Yeah.
Make
he went into the exile. That's
you know, later Frank's father became legendary when the truth came out what had actually happened in those days. And they eventually called the mountain where this battle happened Thabo Liepa, after him.
Yeah. So Thabo means mountain, obviously.
Thabo means mountain, Liepa means, obviously. Yeah. And, the kids got harassed at school. It was just like really shit for them. And eventually dropped out totally from school. And then went through a number of bands like the Real Beats and then acted as session musicians for the Lerebi Queens. And those two bands joined to become the Tycoons. And they were playing mostly Mbaqanga stuff. You know, like he really loved the Mahotela Queens. Every year they used to come down and do a big thing at the stadium.
But this is an interesting thing, is the overlap of Lesotho as an independent country, but it's almost dependence, not, you know, culturally everything on South Africa. They went to South Africa to make a living.
The whole economy of Lesotho was.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, even their main, the mohair was treated in South Africa, so they almost...
Well, they had a bit of a weaving industry there. I went to go and make a documentary on mohair in Lesotho.
That's right.
In 82 or something. That's when I first heard Sanka Motodo playing at the Holiday Inn. The other day, you came down to the madhouse. You didn't mean to do as long as you fall. But they closed the door in your face. Too much music to play, no good for mad case. And I thought, fuck, this is amazing. This is before we'd recorded anything with Shifty. And I approached them and said, would you be interested in doing some recording? At that stage, they were quite desperate because the trajectory of Frank's musical career was that he went through all these bands and then Matabata Sekgwali, the brother of the more famous Tokyo, was exiled in Lesotho. And he really loved their music and organized some new instruments for them. And they formed the band Uhuru, which means in Swahili, freedom. And then they did a tour of South Africa. It was a 12-day tour, only four of which they completed. But on the fifth one, security police were there. Well, obviously the name is going to attract attention, which was the big Uhuru movement in Kenya. Another day, you came down to the madhouse. They must be mad. So where's the big difference, my friend? Seems to me there's not much sense around anyway. There's one great big bad house. The thing is that Uhuru made such a huge impact when they were in South Africa with those four concerts. Fantastic career in front of them.
Yeah, apparently they had interest, record company, and, you know, various...
And then it was because of the interest of the security police and them not being able to come back to South Africa because they were banned from entry after that. All interest disappeared.
So let's go back to why they got banned. And it had to do with the outpourings of one black Jesus on stage, apparently, who kept on shouting out things like, throw the Boers into the sea.
That would probably do it.
This had to do with it, yeah. And black Jesus and his German buddy.
Peter Schneider.
And according to Peter Schneider, it was him who got the band together. He had a drum kit, apparently. He came out from Switzerland. And Black Jesus was apparently spoke German.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's fluent in German.
He'd spent some time in Germany. He was quite a radical guy. He was quite philosophical. And he knew Frank, and Peter Schneider thought Frank was an amazing guitarist. And
I will second that emotion. He was incredibly, if you just listen to the notes that he chooses, he doesn't do a lot of them.
That's exactly the point. It's like Miles Davis was on trumpet.
Right.
So apparently the band kind of cobbled together around the fact that Schneider had a rehearsal room. And I can really relate to that, a band coming together around a rehearsal room.
And a drum set.
Those two key things. And a manager, because Schneider then stepped into the...
Yeah.
And he loved them. He wrote for the rest of his life. He's got quite a nice website that he dedicated to them. This is one of the things I found fascinating was the Peter Schneider crossover point. When I wrote about this, I extrapolated this thing of the mobile recording studio. You and Ivan had cobbled together a recording studio in a caravan called Shifty then, because of the caravan, you could shift it around. And Ivan says that it was your idea, the mobile studio. You know, Ivan was keen on just having it in his flat and just leaving it at that. But he said, Lloyd was fully, So I don't know where you got the caravan from, but that had nothing to do with Ivan either. So it was a Lloyd thing.
Yeah. No,
You purchased it.
I was fascinated by the idea of the mobile studio.
So this is very interesting. And this is where I go back to Peter Schneider in Switzerland, because you must have got this idea at that time. The Rolling Stones had this idea to break away from the record company, set up a mobile studio so they could take drugs and they could record whenever they wanted and they could have a good time, basically party all the time and record a few songs. So they set up what then became the RMS, the Rolling Stones Mobile Studio, in a big truck. They financed it. And then after they'd done their album, they then rented it out. And one of the early adopters, the people who rented that mobile studio, was Deep Purple. They took it to Switzerland. They got set it up in the Lake Geneva shoreline, where Frank Zappa also was doing the last gig of Winter. And he had his band, The Mother's Invention, on the Lake Geneva shoreline. Deep Purple were going to move in after the gig. In fact, I think they were ready to go as the gig was closing down. They moved the mobile studio right in. The truck was parked at the back there. When some stupid with a flare gun
burned the place to the ground.
He shot a flare gun into the raftia ceiling. And Frank Zappa was playing on stage, and he saw this, and he said, "Fire!" And it's not Arthur Brown's song. And then in the audience was a guy called Peter Schneider, who'd taken LSD. And he claims that Frank Zappa was playing the song Fire by Arthur Brown. So he got it all mixed up because his brain was full of drugs.
So it's the same Peter Schneider.
It's the same Peter Schneider.
In
the rehearsal room. Yes. Peter Schneider was in the audience. So on the Sanka Motor site, there's also a whole article about his taking LSD and watching Frank Zappa's gig burn up. And apparently the doors, you couldn't get out. They put chains around the fire escape.
Oh.
So you've got Frank Zappa and Peter Schneider's versions, which are quite. Frank Zappa said we had to use our equipment, cases to smash the windows so the kids could get out, and they went out through some sort of the tunnel that they went to your change room, and the RMS was there, and they had to reverse it out, so that would have been burnt. So there's this funny sort of juncture with the Lloyd's mobile studio, the Rolling Stones mobile studio, and Peter Schneider in the middle of it all, who then after that went to Africa and in the late 70s.
And became a big buddy of Frank's.
And became a buddy of Frank's.
And the manager.
And then he would have already exited stage by the time that you arrived at the mobile studio. But I thought it was a fantastic story, the fact that the manager of Sanka Motor was in the audience. And he jumped out. He said, "That's right." In his thing, he says he was the last guy out.
Really?
He said,
the captain.
like the captain. He looked, and I was the last man out, and he had to jump out of the windows that Frank Zappa's guys had smashed open with.
We're still trying to work out whether he was having a trip or whether it was real or what.
Yeah. And it was a Czechoslovakian who'd shot the, and they couldn't find him. He disappeared. Some sort of
I would too if I was him.
A refusenik, yeah.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Mm-hmm. So there was a hell of a story. So you got the mobile studio, you got that great song, the best riff ever, the rock riff.
And you got House on Fire.
And House, exactly, House on Fire. So that is a fantastic crossover.
Not to mention the two Franks, Frank Liepa and Frank Zappa. Nice aside there, Warwick, but back to the main story. So Uhuru getting kicked out of South Africa was basically the end of that band.
Because, you know, they came back to Lesotho and they were back to square one. And then all the other musicians had to find work. Tepa Chola had gone to be a DJ in Swaziland, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Tepa was actually in Uhuru,
in
the beginning.
At that stage, And then Frank goes to find work in Rustenburg on a mine, but apparently ends up skiving off underground, switching off his light and falling asleep. And when he wakes up, everybody's gone.
No.
And he's smelling fuses burning.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, yeah.
And basically he got
blasted.
I mean, not actually by the explosives, but it caved in on top of him.
What?
And they realized that one guy was missing.
Yeah.
But the fuse was already lit, so they couldn't go down until after the explosion happened. They found him, and he was unconscious for 3 days.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Then once he had recovered, they wanted him to go down again. He says, no fucking ways.
Yeah.
So you could imagine. And he wasn't, you know, he just wasn't that kind of guy. He wasn't a manual. He'd never done manual work before.
Yeah, he was quite small.
He was slight. He wasn't small.
Yeah, he was slight. Yeah, he was slight. Yeah.
He was slight.
Why do you stutter? You're running, you're dying, you're losing your soul.
When you saw them, they were a three-piece band.
Yeah, they were already Sunken Water when I...
Yeah. Oh, were they?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were instrumental in that.
No.
Oh.
Absolutely not. And Sunken Water is, it's a bit of a... I mean, nobody is really certain about Sunken Water, but Paddy Frank
warrior.
Just loved it. It was about Paddy. You could use the word legendary or mythical, I think.
Whether he existed or not,
And with his shield, he dodged the bullets of the Boers and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that brings us up to the point where Frank sent me a demo after I'd spoken to him when I was down there doing that documentary in 1982, probably. And in 83, we went down and recorded him. They didn't need any convincing. They were sitting there basically without any work.
Doing nothing,
Doing nothing.
Just like at the holiday.
Playing to the same people.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a record.
Yeah.
Frank had never recorded before.
He'd never recorded. There are no recording studios in...
There are no recording studios. Ours was the first professionally recorded...
Ever.
...record album...
Yeah.
...in Lesotho ever. Okay, so who was doing the brass arrangements? Rick here, eh?
Rick's brass?
Rick van Heerden's brass.
Yeah.
So Frank had nothing to do with their brass arrangements, which...
It pissed him off,
And Frank actually... I think he still loved the album. His sister just keeps on raving about the album. That's that Frank had a bit of a problem because he wasn't involved in the brass.
The brass, yeah. He said in an interview with Ian Kerkhoff for some music magazine in Holland...
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, he badmouthed the album...
Yeah.
The brass, he said I wasn't involved. The funny thing is, if you take the brass out, and I've listened to it because I found your separates.
Yes.
If you listen to it without the brass, there's nothing happening. It's like long sections.
No, exactly.
You know, it's just like bass and drums.
No, but the other problem with Frank not being there is he wasn't allowed to come to South Africa.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, it would have meant us taking the caravan down.
Back.
To then taking all the musicians down there.
No, there's no way to do that.
No way you can do that. Yeah. I mean, we had no money.
Yeah, exactly. That's an interesting one. How did you finance it?
By my work in the movie industry.
Yeah.
Sound man. Faith Stare.
Faith Stare? Had you done Faith Stare by then?
I had done Faith Stare by then.
Had you done the music for Faith Stare?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And then, of course, half the gear came from Ivan Cady, who was playing with the band National Wake. Our idea was to create this mobile facility that could go anywhere and record this music that the rest of the industry was ignoring, but we actually loved.
heard the call, wake up, got up, took my shield and spear, and I met Sankamota. That's the translation
of
what they're singing now. So obviously Sankamota, the shield and spear. Then he says, moonshine, whisper, whisper in the night. Such a nice language, you know, to Sankamota.
Guitar.
Yeah, that guitar. This is the single note.
Totally simple, but the timing.
And he's got an auto wow on it.
Did I put that on?
Yeah, he must have. Yeah, go.
Who set the house alight?
12 midnight, so who set the house alight? House of fire.
A lot of these songs on here are really fantastic. I'm really happy with this.
It's a good album.
Anyway, so we towed the caravan down to... Were you with me that first time? Or did you come down when I started recording?
I came down when you started recording, but I think it was the first time the caravan went down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'd been down before that.
No, I didn't go before that.
Yeah, I went down before that.
It was me, you and Gay, Lewin.
Yes.
We went down.
Yeah.
And actually, we got to the concrete highway, and if I remember correctly, I'd left my passport behind. And I think we had to pull over and you unhitched the caravan. I had to quickly drive back. It's a sort of Warwick moment.
Ah. But it wasn't that far for us.
No, it wasn't that far, no. But I mean, still, I mean, fuck, you know, so he had to sort of sit there on the
side.
You
didn't just hop out at Uncle Charlie's and walk across the field.
Could have done. But it was the concrete, must have been about a four-hour drive.
Oh.
4 or 5 hour drive, eh?
Oh, what, to Maseru?
To Maseru, with a caravan. It must have been a little bit longer. And I remember the caravan swaying, and it was like
there was a very heavy caravan. You couldn't go, it was still kind of skeleton caravan. It wasn't like aluminium or anything.
It was steel.
The axle superstructure was steel.
Yeah.
So that it's very heavy.
Fat thing.
Yeah.
I remember thinking of it looked like sort of a blue hamburger. And it looked like a bun at the top, bun at the bottom, the blue stripe in between, you know. That's what we use for the logo, the Shifty logo.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the old Radio Lesotho studio they'd moved it somewhere else.
Yeah.
So the old facility was still there with the soundproofing and everything.
Yeah.
So Frank had organized for us to just pull the caravan up on the outside and as we did the recording.
That he organized that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's such a nice recording. You know, it's done in a nice and acoustically treated environment.
You know, we had the 8-track.
Yeah.
And then we had a snake cable, which we just took out the window of the caravan. Through the door into the studio section and
let's
the mics in and off we went.
Yeah, so let's go a little bit more slowly through that for those who don't know what an 8-track is. So you had to record. How did you do it then? You recorded the drums first. We're mic'd up, and the band would be playing demos. Is that how you did it? I mean, you know, the guitar, bass, drums, and vocals.
No, I would have premixed.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. What did you premix from?
I would have recorded them live. So the drums would have gone probably down onto 3 or 4 tracks. It's got that lovely natural sound. I think that's what people respond to.
Yeah.
It's just people playing together. It's so obvious. So how long do you think we recorded? Maybe a week?
Yeah, I think it was a week. Something like that. It felt like a month.
Yeah,
when I look back, it sort of seemed like such a big adventure.
Yeah, and then there was three of them, basically. There was Moss and Nkosi on drums, Frank Leopo on guitar, and the rest.
Maruti on bass.
Maruti Salati on bass.
Yeah. And then you had another guy there.
Sunshine, and he did
keyboards,
but also he contributed to the backing vocals. So each of those people could sing like really lekker. I mean, those harmonies are fantastic.
Amazing. And so, apparently Frank rehearsed them like hell.
Apparently he was a real dictator.
Yeah, that was his thing with vocal. Because Ian Kirchhoff writes about that in the live concert in Holland is where he interviewed them. And that album had just come out and, you know, Kirchhoff was raving about it. It was sort of the best thing ever. But, you know, Frank was reticent. But then Kirko was talking about, or one of the others was saying how Frank rehearsed the vocals, you know, and for their live concerts as well. He was a fanatic for the harmony singing. So in Lesotho, where did we stay? Did we stay in the hotel or what?
Didn't we stay maybe with Moss?
I can't remember where we stayed. We might have done,
We might have stayed with Moss.
With Moss, yeah.
And then, you know, we hitched up the caravan again, brought it back to Joburg, and we started doing overdubs.
Yeah. So you got the caravan back to Crown Mines, where the Shifty house was, off Barragwanath Road, down there near Soweto.
It's actually called Concordia.
Concordia.
Yeah, part of Crown Mines. Yeah.
In the garage, I remember you reversing that caravan. Man, it was difficult to get it in.
Jeez.
It was tight.
Because you couldn't manipulate it by hand. It was so fucking heavy.
It was so heavy, yeah. So you had the Ford V6 Bucky.
Yeah, the one that got stolen two or three times.
That one. We actually had a spate of, the Combi also got stolen. We had desirable cars because the Combi also had some sort of a fat engine inside. But that V6 Bucky was a serious, that had to pull the caravan. So you'd reverse that caravan tightly. I mean, it must have had millimeters to get it through that door. It parked in the zinc garage, baking hot.
Yes.
Yeah. And you were working there, mixing that stuff, and then you got Session, you got Rick to do the brass.
Stompy Monada did the trumpet.
Stompy did the trumpet, that wonderful player. But it's so nice on that album. It complements Frank's guitar style because Stompy was also a man of economic notes but melody, you know.
Yeah.
Melodic solo.
And then on tenor sax was William Ramsey and then Irfan Gillen.
Irfan.
Yeah.
From
Issia.
Issia, yeah.
Tenor sax, Stompy on trumpet and flugelhorn, Warwick on trombone.
Oh, yeah, I had a trombone.
And additional percussions.
Tabla.
Tabla.
And that thing that went creep. Remember, we had that little steel thing that we used on all albums.
Oh, right.
Because you hit it and went creep.
Oh, just by the way, Nasutu is also Sunshine Mokoena on keyboards and backing vocals. And there was a guy called Smonky Chabalala that played percussion as well.
Conga, I think. Proper setup there.
Yeah. And then Lloyd Ross on additional guitars, keyboards, and percussion.
So you were imagining in your mind's eye, you set out you want to be a hotshot record producer, and you knew had to be done.
I didn't want to be a hotshot record producer. I just wanted to record fantastic music, but it was happening that nobody else was recording.
Yeah,
remember that we came from the punk days when all those amazing music was happening. And nobody would record it.
No, but you'd go off and make notes on the you had demos, didn't you?
I did arrangements,
read about how you do it and you make notes and think of arrangements and get someone in to do arrangements and then you'd mix it and a thousand times until you were happy. Until you were almost happy. It was a good sound, I must say. It was. What was your references for that drum sound, for instance?
From the moment I put it on tape, I would take it from there. I wasn't trying to reference anything.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I sometimes think of how I fucked Rick's sax sound up because I think I took all the bottoms out, you know, of that instrument. So it sounds so squeaky.
Really?
It's all my fault, really. I had these ideas about EQing.
About how to fit it in.
And all that kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah.
We did the album. It went out. Everybody loved it. Remember, we had that weird situation where nobody was allowed to go on the airwaves apart from the SABC in South Africa But isn't it wonderful that we had this amazing system of countries inside South Africa that had their own radio stations, if you know what I mean? So Bophuthatswana had their own radio station, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, there's a whole podcast on this.
Oh, yes.
Because of Radio Freedom, which would broadcast in quite crap quality from outside of South Africa.
Was it shortwave?
Shortwave, yeah. The apartheid government decided to spend enormous amounts of money on every one of those homelands building stereo radio stations. And when you've got a stereo radio station in Venda, in Bophuthatswana, in
you're not going to be listening to crappy shortwave.
You've got to have product.
Yeah.
You've got to have a recording studio with all of those, you know, and to record music. So to this day, there's loads of records floating around that were obviously done quite hastily.
Yeah.
But they're great.
There's a podcast on it.
Fantastic, yeah.
We'll have to bring Rob in for that.
Yeah. It would be a good one. Yeah.
Definitely.
All you have to do is think about tomorrow.
So that's why we got television late, because they blew their budget on radio, stereo radio.
Oh, really? They were just scared of the moving image.
There was a thing about the box, the devil's box, they called it. And there was a Verkrampte-Verlichte split and discussions. There was serious discussions about the devil's box.
Huh.
They eventually fell for it, of course. So 1976, we got television.
Mm.
It's amazing to think that when the first punk bands were forming in England, we actually only just managed to get the first television. And a large part of our television was the test pattern. Remember?
I remember watching the test pattern. Yeah. Yes. I think everybody did.
Yeah.
Waiting
for something to happen. So that was...
And then I can't remember the... Can you remember the name of the DJ and... at Radio Bop that took it up and just played it incessantly. Oh yeah, no, hang on. That was Tim Modise. And then there was the rock professor, Chris Pryor, who told me that he bought 3 or 4 Sunken Water albums because he'd worn each of the previous ones out by playing it over and over again. Well, that's a good review. So it became an evergreen for us.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be selling now if people were still buying records. And I think it's an album that really defines where we were going to go, I think.
Tomorrow might feel better than yesterday. Oh, Masi Hambe, Fede Bufane, Lesie,
mixing languages, mixing all these different styles of music.
And no one was allowed to do that in South Africa.
Recording a band.
Well, as this guy said here, you know, you didn't care about it not making money. You just needed to be done.
It needed to be done.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that was the thing. Because it wasn't going to get radio play. The other thing that we haven't spoken on, the sort of slight elephant in the room, I suppose, is it was done with a background of the most hectic politics. I mean, we got to Maseru the year after one of the worst SADF raids. 42 people, I think, were killed. So it was, you know, white South Africans in Lesotho, was a tense, you know, we should have felt a lot more tense than we did.
Yeah.
Which shows that wonderful people they were in.
Yeah.
And then after we recorded it, the year after that, I think, was when Jackie Quinn was killed, with 9 ANC people were killed.
Yeah, her husband was
run. And Jackie Quinn was the person who had the lease to the property we were using.
So we were hiring from her
in
Concordia on Randwine's property.
Yeah.
And we saw it in the newspaper.
Yeah.
I think there was a fucking picture of her on the mortuary slab.
That's right.
So I think it was like Christmas Day or the day before Christmas.
It was
the most shocking thing I've ever seen in my whole life.
That raid was done, I think, the day before Christmas.
In fact, the newspapers had never, ever printed a picture of a dead body.
No, they hadn't. She was lying there with Leon. Was it Leon Mayer? His name. I can't remember his contour name or his actual name. I know that Jackie was mysterious. She had arrived in a Mercedes-Benz with these guys. She was a teacher there, and she started living there, and she was less and less at Concordia. But we had her dog, remember, Demo.
Oh, God. The irritating beast.
The irritating dog that got fed Millimeal. It's amazing. A dog lived on Millimeal.
Really?
Yeah. I think we eventually moved it over to Epoch.
I'm astounded for your attention to memory detail.
But she was involved with the Lesotho kind of scene. She knew Frank and the boys, as she called them.
Mm.
Yeah. But she had a whole ANC kind of thing going on. We didn't know anything about that.
No, nothing.
We were quite naive.
Yeah.
And there was this whole thing that happened suddenly. There, wham. You know, there was a truth commission that happened. That whole thing with Jackie Quinn and her daughters was around. She survived.
So the daughter was a baby in arms?
Yes. The baby in arms was lying there. The parents were lying on the floor dead. They shot her. And later on at the truth commission, it was, what is his name with the glasses?
Eugene
de Kock.
Yeah.
He said, well, you know, what can you expect? We don't make a policy of shooting women, but she grabbed the silencer. And they don't shoot the kids. You know, they weren't going to kill the – he was the ANC target, really.
That he was after.
And she grabbed the silencer.
She got in the way.
Actually staggering thing that came up at the Truth Commission.
I don't know that, Warwick.
Yeah.
That's hectic.
Wow.
Quite a history, eh? And talking about death, you know, just the tragedy of Sankamorta – through the later years, the band that basically they formed with Tepetjola.
Yes.
Just about the whole band got taken out on the N1 when the driver of the minivan did a U-turn in front of a Pantechnicon.
Oh, God.
In front of an 18-wheeler and took the whole band out, basically. Frank wasn't in the thing.
Frank wasn't there.
Chepa wasn't.
Chepa survived. Either. So were they the only two? Of that band?
There were about four or five of them that got taken out.
Yeah.
But already, Moss died of an illness, the drummer from Sankamorta album we recorded, and then Maruti. Do you know about that story?
I do. He jumped off a building.
Was he fell off or he jumped off?
He fell off, no one seems to know.
In England, in London?
Yeah, in London. In fact, if you look at Peter Schneider's website, there's a whole thing on it.
Sounded like quite a sad story.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he was in England and depressed?
Yeah.
Or?
In fact, he had a band called Bushmen Don't Surf.
No.
Yeah.
Like Calorie Surfers, but he stole the name from you almost.
Well, I saw him play. Oh. I went to his gig when I was in London.
Really?
And I went up to him afterwards. I said, do you want to borrow my logo?
No way.
Yeah. They were quite good. I liked them, actually. And he was a sweet guy. He sort of looked a bit sheepish. I was just, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but to use the word Bushman also is kind of slightly risky. Because it's not considered to be so cool.
Well, also, you know, it changes. The coolness of Bushman or San or whatever changes all the time.
It changes all the time, yeah. And I think, but yeah, so they had a lot of bad luck, eh?
A lot of bad luck.
And is this a good time to actually read this little piece from Mahala magazine?
Yes.
There is a guy called Tseliso Monaheng.
Yeah.
Who wrote One-on-One, An Ode to Sankamorta. And this is before Mofokeng's book.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah. So he says, quote, "The history of Sankamorta is as long-winded as it is interesting. It is a dense tale punctuated by varying degrees of bad timing, terrible decisions, and bad luck."
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite hectic, eh?
Yeah.
And then later on, I've got a quote from you here. You said, "Tragedy stalked the various permutations of the band. Of the original Sankamorta that I recorded, there are no surviving members. All of the newer Sankamorta members, apart from Frank and Tsepo, were killed in one tragic accident while on tour, the jam-packed minibus taxi they were traveling in did a U-turn in front of an oncoming 18-wheeler. Mm-hmm. And then 5 years after the minibus accident, Frank released one of his most poignant songs. It's called Another Accident."
Yes.
Yeah.
That's on Frankly Speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing song, actually. The lyrics set out the scenario of a tragedy involving school children in a taxi. Now, this also happened at around that time. So he sort of conflated this thing of being in a mini taxi. And I say here, he jolted the songwriter to remember his own earlier and similar experience, possibly the crash of 1996.
From afar, I can see the children playing in the path. Merrily praying in the path. I
go, I know, because I've been there before. I've seen it all before. From afar, I can hear the children screaming in the taxi. And then there's a ghostly voice as they say, call the ambulance, another accident, a sort of a ghostly chorus thing. And then he says, taxi burning, burning on a day like this.
Mr. Taxi, money, money, money in his eyes.
He gonna be dead.
He died.
So that's why I called it the sort of the hauntology in a way. It's quite haunting.
So, also, as I say, you know, Frank's the male side of Frank's family. Nobody had reached 50, but Frank did.
Did he? I was going to ask you that.
So
yeah.
He died in 2003. They think it was pancreatitis. It was, he was feeling fine, and then all of a sudden he just doubled up, and they took him to the doctor, but he didn't want to go to hospital or something like that, and was hospital. Yeah. You know, Frank is very strong. Even though he spoke very quietly, he was very strong-headed.
Yeah. Similar to Bob Marley, also didn't want to go to hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he basically expired within a day or two.
Wow.
And that was in November 2003.
Yeah.
Probably a month after he reached 50.
Wow,
yeah.
I didn't realize it, yeah.
So he was the first male of his line to reach 50 as far back as they can really remember on the Leopard line.
So Simon Reynolds, who wrote a lot on post-punk, he's a rock writer, really, really good. To go back to the haunting sort of thing. He says, this is quoting him, he says, in a sense, a record really is a ghost. It's a trace of a musician's body, the after imprint of breath and exertion. There's a parallel between the phonograph and the photograph. Both are reality's death mask. Quite nice.
Wow.
Quite an interesting thought, yeah. So that album, in a sense, also was part of my sort of a little kind of thing on it had an aura of it. It had that sadness, man.
Mm.
You know, every time we go back to Frank, you're telling us the story about his father. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's so... sad, actually.
Yeah.
No, and hauntingly sad, actually.
Yeah,
yeah, the ghosts of the band. They really do hang every time you listen to it. And I really felt that listening through and hearing his voice breathing before the vocal track.
On the vocal track.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, and there's a lot there. It's quite fascinating. So I thought, and it fits, for me, it fits into that later became hauntology and also Afrofuturism. They had a real sense of an African... A science fiction mixing up mythology,
maybe just and
all that, you know,
ancestors.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So maybe just read that little bit there. I think it's down to about there. There's Palelo's one.
Is this
from there?
Palelo's book, House on Fire, is a poetic and metaphorical reference to the House of Moshoeshoe or Lesotho being on fire in the 1980s during the longest state of emergency on the continent. Lesotho was plunged into near civil war and state of emergency, and many Basotho suffered in the hands of their own government, and His Majesty King Moshoeshoe II was forced into exile. In many ways, every song of Sankamota can be attributed to a specific portion of our history or circumstances of the time. Many of us sang their songs completely oblivious, with butchered lyrics, mangled Sesotho words, but they still resonated. Something about them just resonates, whether it is the melody, the haunting songs themselves, or the rhythmic dissonance that often catches you square in the face like a rude awakening slap, or the politically charged lyrics, or maybe, in my case, the sound of the finest guitarist's wailing instrument, or to some still the perplexing and tongue-twisting Sesotho words that sound incredible, even though one has no idea what they mean. You've been listening to The Rest is Shifty. For more information, go to shifty.co.za. Or for downloads, find us on shiftyrecords.bandcamp.com.